And that is that only the attorneys and the judges are able to participate. So only their screens are visible. And we ask that when you're not speaking, that you put yourself on mute. And before you begin, because this argument is being recorded, that you state your name and the party that you represent or parties that you represent. And that's the only permitted recording of today's proceeding is the official audio recording that the court is providing. In addition, I want to make a comment about the clock, and that is that if you're in the gallery view, you should be able to see the clock okay, although there are so many folks who are watching today that it might be hard to see that clock, and you may want to pin it so that it shows up and you know how much time is remaining. If you're in the active speaker view, it might get really small. So if you're having a hard time seeing the clock, let us know. I want to make sure you know how much time is remaining for your arguments. And then the last thing is that because of the nature of these remote proceedings, from time to time, there are interruptions or technical problems. We'll do our best to keep them to a minimum, but you know, sometimes pets make an appearance, or there's a doorbell or kids or something. We understand that happens. And we want to make sure that if there is a technical problem, that we are able to accommodate that and give you all the time to which you're entitled. And with that, why don't we begin with the attorney for our appellants today, Mr. Siegel. Oh, I'm sorry. Why don't we begin with calling the case first, and then we can have Mr. Siegel provide his arguments. Go ahead, Marshall.
This is case A211518, A211527, A211528, and A211530, William Findlay et al. Appellants versus Group Health Plan, Inc. et al. Respondents.
May it please the court, Jacob Siegel of the Cerisi Conlon Law Firm on behalf of the appellants. Minnesota's legislature created a clear right for medical patients to access their health records within 30 days and at a reasonable cost. That's the word that the legislature used, right. And there was a good reason for creating this right. Patients often urgently need their medical records, such as when making time-sensitive medical decisions. Appellants here requested their records from the respondents, their medical providers, and four of the largest health systems in the state. And the respondents did not comply with the law. Just as we have alleged, and as must be taken as true for purposes of this appeal from a grant of a motion to dismiss, they routinely and systematically fail to comply with the law by providing records within 30 days of a request. Respondents argued, and the district court agreed, that the legislature did not intend for patients to be able to go into court to seek relief. Now, appellants here are not seeking damages. They're seeking solely prospective relief in terms of an injunction and a declaratory judgment. But respondents nevertheless took the position that appellants have no private right of action, and the district court agreed. That effectively means that if a medical provider simply refuses to respond to a record request, as defendant Essentia has done to this date with appellant Heather Busby, the patient is powerless and a court is powerless to order a medical provider to comply. And it's unreasonable to believe that the legislature intended that outcome. And in fact, the legislature has created two mechanisms by which a patient may seek declaratory and injunctive relief. The first is MnStat 8.31, subdivision 3A, commonly known as the Private Attorney General statute. And the second is the Minnesota Patients Bill of Rights, MnStat 144.651 through 652. Now I'll begin, I'm sorry.
If I may, just given our limited time, looking at the 8.31 subdivision 3A, I just want to be clear. You do believe this is unambiguous, that phrase, any person injured by a violation of any other laws referred to in subdivision 1?
Yes, Your Honor, we do believe that it is unambiguous. We believe it's unambiguous based on the plain meaning of the word refer, which simply means to direct attention to. And we also believe that it is unambiguous when read in the context of the statute as a whole, and the whole statute canon.
And when we look at the stat, I know that when we look to see if something's ambiguous or not, we look at kind of surrounding statutes. Do we here just look at 8.31, or should we also be looking at the Minnesota Health Records Act? Would that be one another place we'd look to determine whether or not this is ambiguous?
So I think I think, Your Honor, for purposes of the whole statute canon, I think we look at this enactment, 8.31. I think that the Health Records Act can be relevant to understanding whether there's a private right of action or not. I mean, we have to certainly understand what the Health Records Act consists of to understand whether it's one of those statutes referred to. We have to understand whether it's a statute respecting unfair, discriminatory, or other unlawful practices in business, commerce, or trade. So in that sense, I believe it's appropriate to consider the Health Records Act itself for that purpose. Now, Your Honor, we believe, as I said, that the statute is unambiguous for two reasons. The first is...
Mr. Siegel, can I just clarify something before we move forward? As I'm trying to map out the different claims here, it seems like there are several possible arguments, some direct claims, some indirect claims. I just want to make sure I'm very clear. There is a claim, I'll use the word indirect for lack of a better term, for bringing a cause of action for a violation of the Health Records Act through the private attorney general statute, but not a claim to recover directly for any violation of the Minnesota Health Records Act. In other words, you're not bringing, there's no cause of action directly under that act. It's indirect through the Private Attorney General's Act. And then the second claim is directly through the Patient's Bill of Rights Act. You're not asking for us to determine whether the Private Attorney General's Act creates an indirect claim under the Patient's Bill of Rights. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's exactly as you've stated. The claims are, first of all, not under the Health Records Act directly. And I think there was some confusion in the district court about that, although we made clear that we did not have a private action under these circumstances under the Health Records Act directly. But we do believe that the Health Records Act is one of the statutes referred to in Subdivision 1 because, and it's really not disputed that it's a statute regarding unfair or otherwise unlawful practices in business. And we believe that that's enough.
If you finish answering Judge Ryan's question, Mr. Siegel?
Yes.
Can I go back to my ambiguity question? Because it does appear to me, so indulge me here for a bit, that perhaps you both have reasonable interpretations of that language. Does it have to be any laws generally or some law specifically cited in Subdivision 1. And if that's true, then we would say it's ambiguous. And so that's why I would like to ask you a few questions about, if we disagree with you. Because I hear you both saying it's plain, and yet you have different interpretations, which sometimes might lead a court to say it's ambiguous. So one of the first places we'd look at would be legislative history. And at least in what I've seen, the legislative history never refers specifically to healthcare records. It's more about, typically about fraud and consumer fraud. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. But I also think that there is legislative history that supports the fact that it was not contemplated to be so narrow. And under that, we can look simply at the fact that the statute was revised 1 year after it was this particular provision was first enacted into law to change the language specifically referred to. Specifically mentioned to referred to the more general term. And in addition, Your Honor, respectfully, we disagree that the statute is ambiguous because reading it in context, the reading that respondents have put forward simply doesn't work. The reading that referred to in Subdivision 1 means the narrow set of statutes just doesn't work. And that's because it's also used three times to refer to the authority of the Attorney General himself or herself. And in fact, in subdivision two, it's used and it's contraposed with the language specifically mentioned. Now,
Mr. Siegel, if you would, what about subdivision three, where it talks about the laws referred to in subdivision one specifically and generally, which it doesn't do in subdivision 3A?
That's correct, Your Honor. It doesn't do that. And the legislature maybe didn't use the most consistent language in the statute. But however, the best reading...
Hence my question about ambiguity, Mr. Siegel.
Yes, Your Honor. And we understand what you're saying, Your Honor. But by the same token, if we look at subdivision 2 itself, that phrase referred to in subdivision 1 can only mean the broader group of statutes, because it then goes on to say that if the Attorney General has reasonable cause to believe that there's been a violation of the statutes referred to in subdivision 1, then he may cause the arrest or prosecution of a person who's violated either the statute specifically mentioned, which everybody agrees is the 10 statutes, or the other statutes that are referred, the other statutes concerning unfair, discriminatory, or unlawful practices. So the only plausible, it's not a plausible reading to say that if the Attorney General has reasonable cause to believe you violated one of the 10 statutes, then, but only then, may he cause your arrest or prosecution for having violated some other statute that's within a wider group.
And you would agree that this question is a question of first impression, that other courts have, I just want to make sure I understand your position on this. Other courts have referred to this and made assumptions, but this hasn't been directly addressed. Fair to say?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's exactly our position. Our position is that cases like Morris, there may be assumptions underlying Morris, but the Supreme Court's decision from 1986, but the Supreme Court has told us, has told courts, do not look at our case and try to put a gloss on it. That would tell you that you can disregard the plain text of a statute.
Mr. Siegel, if I could take a brief step back, and I think it's an interesting question, especially when you get to the second part of the argument that hopefully you'll have some time to address. But when it comes to statutory interpretation, a lot of the textualists would say that there's a distinction to be made between pre-ambiguity and post-ambiguity, and what you look to determine whether ambiguity is there, that there's a specific sequence we have to follow. Those arguments aren't completely reflected in the statute that most of the time our judges believe governs our interpretive principles. So what do you think we can look to determine ambiguity?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I want to make sure I understand the question. To determine if there is an ambiguity or...
Correct. Because there's all these canons of construction that we look to. Once there is an ambiguity, to resolve that ambiguity, we have to interpret and construct. We use those canons to do so, such as legislative history. But most textualists would say you don't look to legislative history to determine ambiguity. That's something that happens in a specific sequence. And so if you could address us to this question, as to this issue, how we determine ambiguity, because I think you were referring to legislative history to support your argument about what this means, but you're also saying it's unambiguous. And that becomes really important in the second claim, because under the court factors or the flower exchange factors, it seems we go straight to legislative intent, even without considering ambiguity at all. So there may be some interpretive principles that we have to apply in determining specifically whether there's a cause of action on your second argument under the Patient's Bill of Rights, that is different from the interpretive principles that we would be using to determine ambiguity and then resolving that ambiguity, statutory construction, in the first issue. So why don't we start with, can we look to legislative intent to determine ambiguity in whether the Private Attorney General's Act is ambiguous?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I think that's both clear in the case law, and it's clear if you look at 645.16, which I think Your Honor was referring to as well, which says that if a statute is unambiguous in its application to a particular circumstance, then that determines the question, and the court should not, look to other factors. There are a series of pre-ambiguity canons that the Supreme Court has identified as such. And in particular, the canon against surplusage, for instance, and the whole statute canon. So those are intrinsic canons. And so generally, I believe that that the court can look to those canons in determining whether or not a statute is ambiguous or not. I'll just pivot, if I may, to your second point and to the Haitians' Bill of Rights. So yes, the second second flower exchange factor or court factor is legislative intent. The primary indication of legislative intent, we believe, is the text of the statute itself, and that's reflected in 645.16. It says that the object of statutory interpretation is to determine the intent of the legislature, and then it says that the text shall not be, if unambiguous, the text shall not be disregarded to pursue the spirit of the statute. But we believe here that there is a clear indication in the text that the legislature contemplated private enforcement. And that's in 144.652, subdivision 2, where the court references private action by or on behalf of a patient.
Right. And so this is the part where I kind of sound like Judge Jessen a little bit in terms of, are there two ways to interpret that provision? And when you're saying there's an explicit right of action, it seems to me that determines or is determined by whether an interested person can be seeking enforcement of this right on behalf of themselves, as opposed to the alternative interpretation of that language, which would be that if the legislature had intended to say any person on their own behalf, they could have said that, but instead they have this more awkward language that seems to suggest you are not bringing it on behalf of yourself, but on behalf of another person. So why is that not, why aren't there two reasonable interpretations of that provision under the Patient's Bill of Rights?
Your Honor, I see my time has almost expired. If I could have a few seconds to answer your question.
You may.
So I think that when you read it in the context of the fact that in that same subdivision, the legislature has indicated that the purpose of the statute is to ensure that the civil and religious liberties of a patient, including the right to make independent decision-making, be protected, then reading that statute, even though that sentence maybe in isolation could be ambiguous, reading it to mean that any interested person, no matter how remote their connection, could bring an action, but the patient, him or herself, could not, would not be a reasonable interpretation of the statute. So if there are any more questions, otherwise I see my time's expired.
There may be more questions. I wouldn't be surprised. Go ahead, Judge Jessen, if you have more.
So looking at that provision of the Healthcare Bill of Rights, Subdivision 1, you referred to the an interested person language. The part that gives me pause with your argument is several lines down where it talks about, okay, so you can seek enforcement either through administrative agencies or in district court, and then it has that language, having jurisdiction over guardianships and conservatorships. Because I must say, if that phrase wasn't there, I would find it much easier to agree. Okay, yeah, any interested person, they can go to district court. But that phrase appears to me to limit it to really folks who are going in on behalf of, in their role as conservators or guardians. Could you help me with that, Mr. Siegel?
Yes, and the final sentence as well refers to guardians and conservators too. So,
I didn't catch that point, Judge Brian. The previous sentence, is that what you're saying?
The final sentence also refers to instructions of a guardian or conservator and complying with those in good faith. So there may be other provisions besides that one reference that seem to limit it.
Yes, as to both of your questions, we do believe that that sentence, the sentence beginning, an interested person may also seek enforcement, and the next sentence, pending the outcome of an enforcement proceeding, those are specific to persons that are subject to a guardianship or conservatorship, and those were later added to the statute. But if you look at it carefully, first of all, the statute says an interested person may also seek enforcement. This is an additional mechanism other than the one referred to in the prior sentence. And it's specific to enforcement of these rights on behalf of a patient or a resident who has a guardian or conservator. So under those circumstances, yes, you must go to an administrative agency or you must go to the court having jurisdiction over guardianship. But that simply doesn't apply here because these patients are not subject to a guardianship or conservatorship. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. And you will have some time remaining on rebuttal. Turning to respondents, attorney, Mr. Lefkowitz, may begin.
Thank you. And may it please the court, Jay Lefkowitz on behalf of the appellees. And I want to get very quickly to this question about ambiguity, but I want to just frame this as follows. It seems like there are two key points amidst all of this disagreement that the parties agree on. One, that the MHRA, the organic statute providing the right to copy records that is claimed to have been violated here, has no private right of action within that statute. And of course, the Supreme Court in the Larson case made that explicit. And number two, that that statute is not among the enumerated statutes in 8.31. Now, the most straightforward reading I would submit of subdivisions 1 and 3A is that private enforcement is available for the enumerated statutes that are specifically referred to. Many appellate decisions in Minnesota confirm that reading. In fact, the 1999 Simmons case that we cited, which was authored by then Judge Anderson, and I think Judge Klapacki was on that panel, basically made clear that even the Deceptive Trades Practices Act, clearly a statute involving consumer protection and the like, was not available for the private right of action because it wasn't expressly delineated. And of course, it makes sense that that would be the case because the whole point of having these statutes, which are added to and subtracted from, in 1973, the private right of action was incorporated into the law here. In 73, they removed the Antitrust Act from this provision. In 1974, they added it back. Then they made various changes. And of course, you wouldn't need delineated statutes if you were just talking about the Attorney General's own authority. The Attorney General can bring cases for any violation of the law in the state. So I do think that that is the clearest explication of how to read the statute. But I recognize, as Judge Jessen pointed out, that there may be some ambiguity here, particularly when you look at one of the other subdivisions. I think it might be subdivision two that talks about referred to. And I think actually the Supreme Court in the Morris case expressly grappled with that because it specifically said, while the list of laws set out in subdivision one is not intended to be exclusive, it is uncertain whether the particular statute at issue in that case, not the MHRA, was ever contemplated by the legislature as subject to the private right of action. And so what the Supreme Court did in that case is it went and it looked to see if there was any legislative indication in that particular statute. Because on the one hand, they recognized that the list was not exclusive, but on the other hand, they clearly recognized that the private right of action does not give a private citizen the right to bring any claim that the Attorney General can bring. And if that were the case, you wouldn't need any delineation. And so what the Supreme Court says was, we look at the legislative intent, and in that particular case, we said no private right of action.
If I may, Mr. Lefkowitz, if we think that this is ambiguous, I understand, you know, one gloss would be the Morris gloss on that, but wouldn't the first place we look be the fact that, you know, a year after the statute was passed, there was an amendment that substituted the current language for the specified language? Because I see you trying to say to us, you know, plain reading of this really means it was specifically referred to in subdivision one, but the legislature changed that.
No, I understand, Your Honor, that the way, the best way to look at this, although there have been several cases following Simmons that just very clearly say, if it's not one of the delineated statutes, there's no private right of action. I think the best way to do this is the way that the Supreme Court elaborated in Morris, and it said, what we have to do when we don't have an enumerated statute is we actually have to look at what the legislative intent was with respect to whatever statute we're dealing with. And that takes you then to the MHRA, which clearly has an express private right of action within it for certain violations. If you disclose records, for example, without consent, if you withhold records, I guess it says you have, I'm looking here at the penalty provision of 144.298, if you negligently release a healthcare record, if you forge a signature on a consent form, those are all things for which there is a private right of action. And then there's also a requirement, a substantive requirement under that law, to provide complete health records. And the Larson Court, looking at the fact that that provision did not have the same private right of action that the others did, and the fact that there was another enforcement mechanism, the Commissioner of Health, within the statute said no indication.
Let me make sure I understand. I'm following what you're saying from me. You're saying we should find the statute ambiguous and then look at the factors unique to the Minnesota Health Records statute as they did in Morris. That would be your proposal for us?
I would submit, Your Honors, that certainly this court could adopt the same rule that was adopted in the Simmons case and in several other cases. However, if I were deciding this case, I would look first at what the Minnesota Supreme Court has said about the private attorney general statute, and I would do exactly the exercise that that court did.
But you would agree with me, would you not, that the Minnesota Supreme Court has not explicitly decided the issue before us as far as whether or not the private attorney general statute allows patients to bring private action to enforce their rights.
Correct. It is not decided in the context of the MHRA or the Patient's Bill of Rights, but what it has decided is that the Health Records Act has no private right of action. And the Court of Appeals has separately said, for all the reasons that I think you discussed when you're talking about guardianship and the like, that there is no private right of action in the Bill of Rights. And therefore, using the framework that the Supreme Court in Morris applied to a different statute to determine whether it would be within the private right of action statute or not, I would find there is clearly no legislative intent here or indication that there should be a private right of action. In fact, just to the contrary, with respect to the underprovision of medical records, I would look to what the Supreme Court said expressly about that statute in Larson, and then I would look at the relevant precedent with respect to the Patient's Bill of Rights.
I look at our decision involving the committed sex offenders, and that was a pretty different context, wasn't it? And I'm not sure, but share with me your perspective on this, you know, whether in that case we addressed the specific argument that Mr. Siegel is making here.
I don't know that you addressed the specific argument, but again, the question that Mr. Siegel is making two different arguments. He's making a textual argument that says, you shouldn't follow the Simmons line of cases. You shouldn't automatically say if something is not expressly delineated, then it's not permissible. And what I'm saying is, if you are going to accept that argument and depart from those lines of cases, then what that takes you to is the Supreme Court's decision in Morris, which actually recognized this form of ambiguity and said the way we solve this, obviously only in the case that it was before them at the time, they weren't articulating a standard for every single substantive statute, but they said, you look to see whether there is an indication that the legislature wanted this particular statute or that particular statute to be privately enforced. And then I would say, you look to your precedents. Clearly on the MHRA, you have a precedent from the Supreme Court in Larson that could not be more clear and could not be more on all fours.
Counsel.
Yes.
The 10-day rule, or 30-day rule, I mean, to respond
to
the rule to respond, time limit to respond to requests for records.
Yeah.
Where would you identify a remedy? for noncompliance?
All of the rights that are in that are accorded to people in connection with the MHRA, other than the three specific ones where the legislature provided a private right of action, are subject to supervision and disciplinary action by the appropriate licensing agency.
In your knowledge, how long does investigation and disciplinary actions take?
I actually don't know. I know that the commissioner has...
My question is that a realistic remedy to the requirement that it be supplied within a time limit?
Well, certainly if someone believes he or she has been harmed by a provider who hasn't provided relevant documentation, in the absence of a private right of action, but where the legislature has said there can be disciplinary action, I think the appropriate step would be to go to that licensing board or agency and suggest that there needs to be something done. And certainly in this
situation, Mr. Lefkowitz, if I can interrupt, because the something done is kind of the important part of this. Where does it, do you think disciplinary action would include disclosure of the requested documents?
Well, the disclosure could come simply from a subpoena attendant to a malpractice action. For example, in the situation where this arises here,
I understand there's an alternative way. If there is a malpractice action that is filed, we have rules of discovery, but that's different from the 30-day right that is in the statute. So how would you enforce that right if disciplinary action doesn't on its face include disclosure and potentially is something different than disclosure? How do you enforce that right? Or are the plaintiffs correct that it's an illusory right?
I don't believe it's an illusory right. Certainly any regulator that has the authority to take someone's license away can certainly say to a provider, I don't like what you're doing. And if you don't comply with the law, I am going to pull your license and pull your ticket. In other words, I think that is...
Yeah, I agree with you theoretically, but is there any concrete or real life example of that being the disciplinary action?
I don't have a concrete example, but what I do know is that the legislature, when it promulgated the statute, created various rights and specifically said some of those rights are redressable in a private action, and others, it did not say that. And this very issue was litigated in the Larson case. The Larson case says, and I'm quoting from the Supreme Court's opinion, we next consider whether Minnesota Statute 144298 creates a private right of action for the under-disclosure of medical records. And it makes very, very clear that there is no private right of action for the under-disclosure of medical records, which is what we are talking about here.
Mr. Lefkowitz, if I may, I think this discussion really kind of highlights an additional question I have for you, which deals with you make the point that even if we found kind of a private right of action initially, kind of we read the Private Attorney General's Act statute the way that Mr. Siegel wants us to, that there would be no public benefit, so it couldn't go forward. And I think that Judge Klapowski's questions about, well, you know, is there really a realistic enforcement of these rights? Now, it gets to my concern with that argument that there would be no public benefit here. So that's one thing, since the allegation is that your clients have systematically violated the Health Records Act. I would like your response to that. But I also like, if we reached that issue, should we be reaching that issue? Wouldn't that be one, since it wasn't addressed by the district court, that we should send back to the district court to further develop the record?
I see I only have half a minute left. I want to try to answer all parts of that question briefly. Number one, I think even if you accepted counsel's argument, the argument is not an argument that any statute at all is subject to the private right of action. That would clearly be an overbroad argument. The argument would only be from the text that a non-enumerated statute may be available for a private right of action. And then I think the Supreme Court directs you to do this analysis of statutory intent. I don't believe that there's any public benefit here. And in fact, the case that they rely on, Kinetic v. Medtronic, is a perfect example, because in that case, the misrepresentations, omissions were made to the public at large. Here, we have four different lawsuits involving very individualized claims. They're not even the same claims. Appellants don't identify any specific policy or procedure by the four appellees that impacts the general public. It is true they are seeking injunctive relief, but this court, various courts in Minnesota, have made clear that merely seeking injunctive relief is not sufficient to establish a public benefit. And I would finally just say, just because my time is up, I don't even believe that the MHRA is a statute that falls within the ambit of unfair and unlawful practices. This court and the Supreme Court have looked at cases involving the unfair claims practice, the insurance fraud statute. None of those were necessarily accepted. And I would say that this case is a regulatory statute. It is not a unfair competition or unlawful practice statute.
Judge Brian?
Go ahead.
Could I ask, I know that our time is, Mr. Lefkowitz's time has expired, but I would like to ask him to briefly address the second part of my previous question, which is that if we reach the issue of the whether the there's a public benefit advanced, whether we should be deciding that or sending it back to the district court for further development.
I think if you found that there was, you're saying if you found that there is a public benefit here?
No, what I was suggesting was that if the court, this is hypothetically, believed that, read the private attorney general statute not to be limited to those enumerated ones and to include this, then we would necessarily reach the, but is this a public benefit question, right? And so my question is whether, because you were suggesting in your brief that we could decide that on this record. And my question was, you know, getting your reaction to, if we reach that issue, should we be sending it back to the court?
I would say, okay, so if you decide that there is a private right of action from the MHRA or the MPBR, which requires, in my view, not just this textual question, but then the secondary Morris step, I think you wouldn't necessarily have to reach the public benefit if, unless you also disagreed with the trial judge that the statute was, in fact, an unfair competition type statute. If that were the case, too, then you'd reach public benefit. I believe that you could look at the pleadings themselves here. This is obviously a de novo review of the legal standard. And I think if you look at the pleadings in the case, there's nothing in the pleadings that suggests that this is actually a public case. This is a case involving, or four different cases, each involving unique idiosyncratic facts and circumstances, which is what the court looks at when it looks at public benefit.
There was a request in this matter for class action, was there not?
I believe there was a request for a class action.
So that would bear on whether the public is beyond simply the litigants here, but that's all been deferred.
Correct. And just because someone requests a class action obviously doesn't mean that the case necessarily is either cert worthy or that it actually involves a public.
Do you think it's required that a trial court find that people who are applying for life insurance and have to get medical records, or who have all kinds of other reasons, you transfer from one doctor to another and need medical records, and you make the request in 30 days and nothing happens, that these aren't, that there aren't literally thousands of people out there who would benefit by being, of having easy and clear and prompt access to those records?
Your Honor, I think if the plaintiffs had an allegation that, for example, the healthcare providers at issue or the healthcare providers who are the defendants had a policy, for example, of not responding to record requests for 60 days or 90 days, that would be something that would be a public-facing allegation. This is an allegation that my records or someone else's records were not, in fact, produced in the proper way at the right time. And each of these different sets of allegations are quite different here.
So are you suggesting then that there's no policy that drives these providers, that they're individually and maybe in a discriminatory fashion deciding who gets records and who doesn't?
I don't know. We haven't had, we only know what was alleged in the complaint. And what was alleged in the complaint was very idiosyncratic complaints about different providers. Some appellants requested their records personally and claimed they didn't get them in time. Others had attorneys request them. The appellees had different rationales for not providing the records. I don't believe that this qualifies for the public benefit test as established by the court. But again, the public benefit issue is kind of a belt and suspenders. Even if there is a public benefit at issue, if there is no private right of action in the statute, in the underlying statute, then I don't see how under Morris there could be a private right of action under the Attorney General statute. I think there would have to be some indication that the legislature wanted private redress in court as opposed to using regulatory or agency procedures in order to find that a non-enumerated statute qualifies under the Morris opinion for private Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Lefkowitz. Mr. Siegel, this is your rebuttal. And perhaps you can start where Mr. Lefkowitz left, because that seemed to be part of the bulk of his argument. Do you agree that the only non-enumerated statutes that through the Private Attorney General's Act, a person would have a right of action for to allege violations for, are those non-enumerated statutes that already have a private right of action in them?
So, no, Your Honor, I don't agree with that. I think there are a number of problems with that argument. I mean, the first is that simply it's inconsistent with the text, because the text has a list and it refers to that list and says specifically but not exclusively. Mr. Lefkowitz's reading ultimately is exclusively but maybe not if there are some other factors of some sort which are not specified but are implied somehow in Morris. Morris is actually much narrower than Mr. Lefkowitz is suggesting. If you look at the first page of Morris, it describes the issue in the case as follows. The issue may be framed this way. Does MnStat 72A.20, the Unfair Claim Practices Act, either alone or in conjunction with 8.31, afford a private party a cause of action against an insurer for violation of the act? That was the issue that the Supreme Court was addressing, the Unfair Claims Practices Act. It did not say that in all cases, if you come across a statute regarding unfair, discriminatory, or unlawful practices in trade or business, you have to do a further inquiry to determine whether or not they're within the scope of the Private Attorney General statute. Mr. Lefkowitz also suggested that this statute is not, in terms of the plain text, a law respecting unfair, discriminatory, or unlawful practices in trade or business, because he's putting a gloss on that just means laws regarding fraud and deceptive practices. But that's not what the statute says. We have to look at the plain text. That's what the Supreme Court has told us to do time and time again. I'd like to address the public benefit point very briefly. And that's just to say that respondents' argument here simply disregards the allegations in our complaint. Because we do allege that there was a uniform practice or procedure. That's, for instance, in the Findling complaint at paragraph 62, I believe. Frankly, we have alleged and we know it to be the fact that there are thousands of people who have likewise been deprived of their records in violation of the act. And in fact, we put in some affidavits because we had submitted our opening briefing on class certification before this motion went in. So there's actually evidence before the district court, not that it's relevant in this posture, but there is in fact evidence of a widespread practice.
So if I can just put a point on that, are you saying we can look to the evidence, as you put it, that was presented regarding the motion to certify a class in determining whether there's a public benefit, or do you agree that we are limited to the allegations in the complaint alone?
I think at this stage of the proceeding, the court is limited to the allegations in the complaint alone. But by the same token, the district court for the federal district court has said that the public benefit requirement is not onerous. Those are its words. I think that the court would apply a similar type of inquiry to that, that it would apply in the standing context, right, where the Minnesota courts follow the Supreme Court precedent that standing must be established in the same way and at each stage of the proceedings as the merits must be established. So you would look at the allegations of the complaint and construed most favorably in the light of the plaintiffs. Is there no possibility that we could adduce evidence of a public benefit? And I think you simply cannot get there based on the allegations in the complaint. I do very briefly want to address the issue of a comprehensive scheme of administrative enforcement. That is what the Morris court said the Commerce Department's supervision of insurers provided, a comprehensive scheme of administrative enforcement. And I think as the court's questions are getting at, we simply don't have that here. We have a reference to there being some potential possibility of disciplinary action. They've not given a single example where the Commissioner of Health has taken disciplinary action for violation of this requirement. And in fact, they haven't even given a single example where there's been an investigation. We don't believe the Commissioner of Health understands herself to have the power to take any action here. And in any event, I think the point was well taken that even if disciplinary action would be a theoretical option, that does nothing to get the patient his or her records within 30 days. And the legislature added that requirement that the records be provided within 30 days because it realized that these requests can be very urgent and it realized that patients need to have their medical records in a timely manner. And for those reasons, we respectfully ask that you reverse the decision of the district court and remand for further proceedings.
Are there other questions from the members of the panel? I know we gave Mr. Lefkowitz, well, actually both attorneys had a little additional time. So any additional questions? Judge Jessen? Judge Klapke? Okay. Well, I want to thank the attorneys for their arguments and their submissions. We